Sya-gananjana-salakaya Chaksur-militam yena Tasmai-shi-gurve-namaha Shri-chaitanya-mano-diksham Savitam yena-bhutale Swayam-rupa-kadamayam Tadati-swapadantikam Vandeham Shri-gura-piyuta-parakamalam Shigram Vaishnavamscha Shirupam Sagridatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitham Tham Sajivam Sadvaitam Sabadutam Vrijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shiva Sakam Svitamscha Hey Krishna Karna Sindho Dina Bandho Dugatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Chapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavane Shri Prishubhanu Siddha Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakapa Dhruvyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Paditanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Pranitananda Sharvaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Thank you all for coming. So happy to be here in Dallas. Nice and warm. How many of you have read the Bhagavad Gita? How many of you have heard of the Bhagavad Gita? Good. We're on the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita called Karma Yoga, Action, Krishna Consciousness. How many verses do they really usually go through? Doesn't really matter. Even one is all right. Okay. So this is text number one. Arjuna Vacha Sanyasam Karmanam Krishna Puna Yoga Chasam Shasi Estreya Ekantam Egruhisanis Jitam. Arjuna said, O Krishna, first of all you asked me to renounce work, and then again you recommend work with devotion. Now you kindly tell me definitely which of the two is more beneficial? Prabhupada's purport. In the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that work in devotional service is better than dry mental speculation. Devotional service is easier than the latter because being transcendental in nature, it frees one from reaction. The second chapter, preliminary knowledge of the soul and its entanglement in the material body were explained. How to get out of this material engagement by Buddha Yoga or devotional service was also explained therein. In the third chapter, it was explained that a person who is situated on the platform of knowledge no longer has any duties to perform. In the fourth chapter, the Lord told Arjuna that all kinds of sacrificial work culminates in knowledge. However, at the end of the fourth chapter, the Lord advised Arjuna to wake up and fight, being situated in perfect knowledge. Therefore, by simultaneously stressing the importance of both work and devotion and inaction knowledge, Krishna has perplexed Arjuna and confused his determination. Arjuna understands that renunciation and knowledge involves cessation of all kinds of work performed in sense activities. But if one performs work in devotional service, then how is work stopped? In other words, he thinks that sannyas, or renunciation of knowledge, should be altogether free from all kinds of activity, because work and renunciation appear to him to be incompatible. Here is not to have understood that work in full knowledge is non-reactive and is therefore the same as inaction. He inquires therefore whether he should cease work altogether or work with not full knowledge. So the verse again, Arjuna Vacha Sanyasam Karmam Krishna Kunar Yoga Samshasi Arjuna said, O Krishna, first of all you ask him to renounce work, and then again you recommend work with devotion. Now you kindly tell me definitely which of the two is more beneficial. Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasadaya Vajaya Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swamite Namne Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Vacharne Some words are used here that we could get some definition for. One of them is knowledge. Knowledge described here is not academic knowledge or technological knowledge. Knowledge means to understand the difference between matter and spirit and who the controller of both is. From the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has explained the fact that we're not this body. Quite a simple philosophy, and for most people, very difficult to conceive of. But, Krishna says, Deno smita dehe omaram yovanam jara tata dahantara praptir simple facts that, number one, our body is changing. I think all of us realize that our body is changing. And another simple fact is that in spite of all the changes of our body, we ourselves are the same person who's perceiving the body. Some of us can remember when we were 5 years old, when we were 10 years old, or 15 years old. So we were the person who was perceiving, conscious of that particular body. So certainly, every moment our body is changing, but at every moment we're still that person who's conscious of these different bodies. So to become aware of ourselves, that's called knowledge, theoretically understanding that the body is changing but the soul is the same, is not full knowledge, it's preliminary knowledge called jnana. Real knowledge, or vijnana, means to actually realize the difference between ourselves and the body. If one is actually realized that he's not the body, then he becomes prasanatma. Prasanatma means he becomes joyful. Brahma Bhuta prasanatma, nishoshati nakamshati. Now in your world, everyone is hankering for something and lamenting over something. So what are we hankering for? We're hankering for something that the body is demanding. It may be gross, or it may be subtle, in the sense that the body has so many demands. Vata vegam, manasa krodha vegam, jiva vegam, udra pasta vegam, Etan Vegam Yogesh Hetadira Sarvam Apimam Pratidim Sashisha. There's the urge to speak, the mind's demands, the forces of anger, the urges of the tongue, the belly, and the genitals. Although, somehow or another, we're convinced that this is reality, this is life, to serve our senses. But we have to go back and again look at the fact that we're not the body. From that point of view, it doesn't make any, it's not the ultimate objective of life, it's just to serve the demands of the senses. Of course, without perceiving, without understanding the nature of the soul, it all seems quite theoretical. In other words, we want to do something, so why not serve the senses? In any case, first we have to understand that we're not the body, and that presently, in some way or another, we're engaged in fulfilling the demands of the senses. When we're hungry, we want to eat. When we're sleepy, we want to sleep, etc. So that's called sense gratification. Now, knowledge means to come to a platform where we're not affected by the demands of the senses. We ourselves are not affected. Just like, for instance, if one is in a car, it is not that knowing that I'm not the car doesn't mean that I don't fill up the gas tank. But when I fill up the gas tank, it doesn't mean that I think my life is perfect. Or when I turn off the car, it doesn't mean that I think, now I feel completely good and peaceful. The car is turned off. Or when I start up the car, it doesn't mean I suddenly feel like I'm full of energy. One understands that I'm not the car. Unfortunately, in conditioned life, we so much identify ourselves with this body that our whole existence is the body. And we think when the body is in a healthy, nice condition, that we ourselves are healthy and nice. And when the body is in a miserable condition, we think we're miserable. We're identified so much with the body. Just like one may be identified with a car. The advantage of discriminating or realizing ourselves as a soul is that we become joyful. Without that experience as being a soul, then there's no question of joy. If I think that in 15, 20, 25 years or 10 seconds, I'm going to die and disappear, it's very hard to be joyful. If I think I'm going to live forever, then practically all my problems are solved because I have no problems. This body has a lot of problems, and it'll have a lot more problems in the future. If you think things were bad now, just wait a while. When you look back, when you were young, probably you were healthier, but you're a lot healthier now than you will be when you get another 20 years. The body is, but we are not the body, we are the spiritual soul. So yoga, the purpose of Bhagavad Gita, is to come to the platform of knowledge and to realize ourselves as souls. Then we become prasanatma. And if you realize oneself as a soul, one has to give up shoshati and kamshati. One has to not serve indiscriminately the demands of hankering and lamentation. Sometimes we may have to serve the body, just like one may serve the car by providing water and air and gas and oil and cleaning the car. One may have to serve the body without that type of attachment to the demands of the body. Now, there are different types of yoga, as explained here. Arjuna's asking which yoga is the best yoga. There's a yoga where one gradually gives up, one performs with his body dutiful activity. That is, basically speaking, in order to maintain the body, we only need some basic things, like food, for instance. Anabhavati bhutana. Of course, nowadays people are under the illusion that they're making progress in economic development. That's totally an illusion, actually. There is no economic development, nor is there any real sense gratification. Previously, people would have to know what the laws of Dharma are, or how the universe is actually working in order to get food, at least, and shelter, eating, sleeping, mating, defending. These are the basic things of life.
And the first thing is eating. So nowadays people think they're making progress, but actually they're going backwards because they're in ignorance. Now what do I say they're going backwards? Because food means not something you buy in the store. That appears to be food, but it's not necessarily food. It just looks like food. For instance, they did an experiment to find out the nutritional value of shredded wheat. Everyone's heard of shredded wheat, at least in America, our famous breakfast cereal. And they fed rats shredded wheat. They opened the box, put the box in the cage with the shredded wheat, and the rats, they ate the box and left the shredded wheat because they had more intelligence than eating the shredded wheat. And we can analyze so many different foods. Practically speaking, our food is devoid of nutrition. It's grown on chemicals, which are covered with insecticides and pesticides. It's whatever, it's harvested by big machines. And then it's more or less processed through different processes. If there was anything that was actually nutritious, well, you'd have to pay to put any nutrition back into it. But practically speaking, it's as good as cardboard for the most part, most of the food that's in the store that one buys. And then colors are added to it, and preservatives. That's not really food. Food means something that you can digest, according to Ayurveda. And poison is something that you can't digest. So not only the food's not very good, but people can't even digest whatever little value of food that what we're eating has. They don't know how to even chew nowadays. We're not even taught that you should chew the food. Sometimes you can see people walking down the street with their lunch, eating it. One time I was on an airplane, and the person I was talking to was watching a movie while he was talking to me. So that would be bad enough, but he also had headsets on and he was listening to rock music. And he was smoking a cigarette. It was during the time when they had smoking section. And at the same time he was eating his meal. And talking to me, telling me how much anxiety he was in. So even to eat the food is difficult. There's so much distraction, people are so much in anxiety, worrying about the future, lamenting about the past, and the value of food is quite minimal. Therefore, even for the most basic understanding of how to gratify the eating process, the senses for eating, that's a great mystery for most people. They don't know what to eat, they don't know how to eat, they have no understanding of what they're eating, the quality, when it was, where it was grown, when it was picked, how it was cooked, nothing. They have some faith. It's simply blind faith. It doesn't matter what you eat or how you eat it. Somehow or another, it's all going to be come out all right. And if it doesn't come out all right, then the scientists supposedly have a cure for everything. If you didn't digest it, you take a pill, it'll digest the food for you. If you can't eliminate the unnecessary part, you take a pill. It's all pills. You can't go to sleep, you take a pill. You can't wake up, you take a pill. Pills are digesting your liver, you take another pill. Your bones dissolve, they give you plastic. Your brain doesn't work, they give you plastic. Then people have blind faith in the so-called advancement of civilization, but it is just blind faith. It doesn't produce any real, even the most basic knowledge of how to eat, how to sleep, what relationships are, how to become free from anxiety. They have shelves of books all about anxiety. But the people who are writing the books are full of their anxiety themselves. They're only writing the books so they can make money to get free from their anxiety. In other words, unless we can understand that we're not the body, then we're actually spirit souls, then whatever we do afterwards is going to be wrong. If you take 1 + 1 and you wind up with 3, then afterwards, whatever expertise you may have in mathematics, you'll still get the wrong answer. When we take the soul plus the body and we only wind up with the body, then we're not very good in anything, especially in math or whatever. But actually, it's the soul plus the body means that the soul is conditioned by the body. And to maintain the body, at least one should know basically how to eat properly, what to eat, when to eat. Not that every time my senses say, eat, then immediately I eat. And it doesn't matter what I eat, I just reach into the bag, get out the Fritos or whatever else it is, stuff it in my mouth, crunch my mouth, maybe move my teeth up a few times, and swallow. And if someone asks you at the end of the movie, what did you eat? You can't quite remember. It was in a bag, I remember it was in a bag. Or maybe it was a box, I don't know, there was a box in a bag or something. There's some salt on it, I believe. I don't feel very good, but I got my, whatever, Alka-Seltzer. I'm sure I'll dissolve it away. In other words, even some basic knowledge is explained here. Now, yoga means how to gradually, first of all, understand what dharma is. Basically, dharma means, for instance, if you're an ant, you should eat like an ant. And if you're an elephant, you should eat like an elephant. But if you're an ant, you try to eat like an elephant, obviously you'll have some problems. These basic little things. And then the higher dharma is called the lower karma. That whatever we're doing, whatever we're speaking about, whatever we're thinking about, there's going to be a reaction. There are basically enemies of the self, of self-understanding, like lust and anger and greed and madness and envy. So these basic things, an illusion. So it is not that I can cultivate lust and it stops there. It is not possible that I'll simply be lusty and I'll enjoy lust and that's it. Because according to Bhagavad Gita, lust is not something that's desirable. Krishna says that lust is never satisfied and it burns like fire. Because we call that love. I love you. Oh, my pain, my heart, I just feel this love for you. I just love you so much. Ah, this feels so bad, but I love you. Anyhow, that's what people think that's love. The demands of the senses, pushing the soul to eat, sleep, mate, defend, it's called love. I love my donuts, I love my car, I love my wife, I love my football team. We think that's all love. But after a while, if we do satisfy our senses, then we want to satisfy them more. We eat one ice cream cone and we think, oh, that was good, I want another one. And another one. Until we can't eat anymore, and we think, oh, it's so bad. It's so bad. And probably one said that before the feast, or one time one of his disciples came to him and said, Prabhupada, I just got married. I feel so bad. Because now I can't serve you, and I have to work with my wife. So Prabhupada said, yes, it says, before the feast, everyone is thinking, oh, I can't wait for the feast, it's going to be so good. And then after the feast, if one has eaten too much, you think, oh, I feel so bad. If only I didn't have to eat so much of that feast. So greedy. I want more and more. Just like here in Dallas, there is the Howard Hughes' mansion. So one time they interviewed Howard Hughes. He was a billionaire. They said, "My dear Howard Hughes, now that you have so many billions of dollars, what do you want?" He said, "I want more money. I need more." So never satisfied. So that's called greed. People are thinking if you become greedy, you're a good person. These ordinary people who only have a few million dollars are not very important. But the greedy people have billions of dollars. Oh, these are the important people in society. These are the successful people who become really greedy. And greed doesn't stop with greed. Because we become greedy, eventually we can't satisfy our greed. Then we become frustrated and angry. But you're the cause. You're the one who, I'm going to get you, my enemy. He's my enemy. I've killed him. Ugh. My other enemies will all be killed. Watch it. Then we become angry and frustrated. And it doesn't stop there. Then we imagine that everyone else is the fault. I'm innocent. I'm a good person. Even Two Gun Pete, he thought he was a good person. You all know Two Gun Pete? He's glorified in a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. I think it's Carnegie? Yeah. He was writing about how everyone believes that they're always right and that everyone else is at fault. Two Gun Pete, he was in Chicago in the 1920s. Part of Al Capone's gang. And he was called Two Gun Pete because he was famous. He'd always kill his victims with two guns. One time he was on Lover's Lane, and one unfortunate policeman committed a great offense. He actually put the light of his flashlight, he shone it, into the car. Two Gun Pete understood that it was a great offense, and he got out of his car and shot the policeman. But he was afraid because his reputation would be spoiled. So he took the policeman's gun and shot him again, just to make sure his reputation as Two Gun Pete was not disturbed. Unfortunately, the other policeman did not appreciate Two Gun Pete's reputation. His inner feelings of shooting the policeman. So they chased after him. Finally, they cornered him at a house, and before his exit from the scene, he wrote a letter to his mother and said, "Dear Mom, I'm actually a nice person. People just don't understand. Please take care of the cat, your son Pete." So everyone believes that whatever they're doing is correct, is nice. People just don't understand. So this is called delusion. And from delusion, Krishna says, comes bewilderment of memory. We forget what is the standard. We forget all the nasty things we did, and we only remember the good things we did. We forget, well, all the problems we've been through, one may look back, and Maya will say, actually it was very sweet. It was so nice that now if you simply go back and try again, you've learned so much, this time you'll get it right. Sometimes we may dream, if only I could start all over again, I'd get everything right. Just do it again. Get retested by being 5 years old and becoming perfect, getting that spelling test 100% this time. So we think, if only back then I made a few mistakes, but actually there were so many good things. So that's called forgetfulness. We forget all the bad things, we remember the good things sometimes, or we forget whatever good there was. We heard, we only remember the bad we've learned. And then we forget intelligence. We forget even that there could be a purpose of life. We lose our intelligence understanding even basic things. Like there's a controller behind the universe. We forget we lose our power even to understand that I'm not this body. If you ask someone on the street, what's the difference between a living body and a dead body? You know what most people say? If you ask them, what's the difference between a living body and a dead body? Anyone can guess what most people say? Yes. What's that? Heart stops.
20 years.
20 years. Actually, most people say the difference between a living body and a dead body is that a living body is alive and a dead body is dead. That it's easier to explain to a 5-year-old child the difference between the changing body and the person who's aware of the body than it is to explain to a 50-year-old professor. The child will catch it on much quicker. So that's called loss of intelligence. Although we're thinking we're making advancement, but by the process of lust and anger and greed and illusion and forgetfulness, we're actually losing all our intelligence, our real intelligence, to understand who we actually are. Now the question is the process of giving up lust, anger, greed, beginning by doing things that are dutiful, not being dictated by the senses, doing things according to the laws of nature. Then, coming to the platform through austerity and cultivation of knowledge, where we can differentiate between ourselves and the body. We can actually see with our intelligence, it is a fact that I'm eternal, that I'm the soul within the body, that I'm not changing, it's only the body that's changing. Living more or less in a state of existence where one is not unrestrictedly trying to gratify the senses, nor trying to make arrangements simply for the comfort of the body. Instead, doing things that will purify the consciousness, regulate the senses, so that it becomes clearer who we really are. Just like if you have a pond and you have in the pond dirt. If you constantly stir the water and the dirt, then the whole thing becomes cloudy. But if you simply let the water stand still for some time, then after some time, then the dirt will settle down and one will be able to see the dirt on the bottom or some object on the bottom of the lake. Similarly, if our whole life is simply stirring up our material consciousness, then it becomes very difficult to see the soul within our body, to understand our real self. So yoga is that. But here it mentions, Krishna says, even better than that type of yoga is the yoga of devotion. So that yoga of devotion means that there is a supreme person. As we are souls, there is a supreme soul. The difference between ourselves and the supreme soul is that we're a little tiny soul and the supreme soul is an unlimited soul. As we have a tendency to love, so the supreme soul, he has an unlimited tendency to love. Now we're loving this body. We get up in the morning. We look in the mirror and we ask the mirror, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the greatest of them all? And of course the mirror answers back and says, you're looking into the mirror, you're seeing the absolute truth directly. If somehow or another the effulgence of the mirror disappears, you'll be able to see the absolute truth perfectly. And with such a realization, we become so enthusiastic to worship this deity that we see before us, that we offer it abhishek if we're a little pious. That is, we take a bath or shower. And then we decorate the deity, we clothe the deity, we put perfume on the deity, we paint it up, we look at the deity again, and we think, wow, amazing. It's even more beautiful now. Its beauty is increasing. then we feed the deity, and then we go out and we spread the glories of the deity all over the world. We call that Sankirtan. In other words, this body has become our worship. We're feeding and we're serving it. Unfortunately, the deity pays us back for all our service with old age, disease, and then we die. Life is tough, difficult, and then you die. Sounds pretty pessimistic, doesn't it? Sorry. Well, the fact is that the latest statistics in Dallas, Texas are, in spite of all scientific advancement, the death rate here is still 100%. Life is tough, and then you do die. But the soul does not die, and the soul is supposed to become liberated from the material entanglement through some kind of process. So we love this body, we're serving it as our worshipful deity, but there is a worshipful deity who's the reservoir of all pleasure, unlimited pleasure. Of course, we can say the word pleasure. It doesn't mean anyone's experiencing pleasure just by saying the word pleasure. We can, you know, write down pleasure on pieces of paper and throw them over us, trying to get some pleasure. So just the word pleasure will not make us happy. Just saying that there's a deity, there's a personality who's the reservoir of all pleasure, will not give us pleasure. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna scientifically explains how there is a creator behind the material world. The sun's rising is a point in time. The sun's setting is a point in time. Snowflakes that are falling, precise geometric patterns. There are so many things that are going on in this world that are produced by intelligence. And intelligence means people have intelligence. Rocks and air and space doesn't have intelligence. Its living entities have intelligence. So this wonderful creation, so intelligently made, has been made by an intelligent person. Right away we can see that that intelligent person is much greater than we are. Although the scientists claim everything has come about by accident, but that means that they're just not very intelligent. Because even if they claim everything has come about by intelligence, well, with all their intelligence, why can't they create a sun that they claim came about by accident? If they have intelligence, then they're supposed to be able to do things that go beyond simply accidental occurrences. No one will claim, for instance, that a watch has come about by accident. Everyone knows an intelligent person invented it and manufactured it. If someone said that a watch came about by accident, everyone knows that this person is less intelligent. So when the scientists say that something has come about by accident that they themselves can't create, that means that they're less intelligent. Because they don't understand how it came about. Therefore, to minimize the person who created it, they say it's an accident. Just like one friend told another friend, our friend, Mr. Patel, I've gone to the court, I saw him, he's now become a high court judge. So his friend said, no, that's not possible. Mr. Patel can never become a high court judge. The guy's a fool. I know him since we were children. The guy is completely spaced out. He could never become a high court judge. No, I was in the court today. I saw him. He actually became a high court judge. All right, maybe he's a high court judge, but I'm sure they're not giving him any salary. So the same way some people look at the universe and they say, oh, the planets are moving their orbits, the sun's rising is a point in time, there are so many amazing things. Just like if a scientist could create two different machines, a male machine and a female machine. And when they get together, they create little machines, and little machines grow up and they become big machines. I've given this analogy before, but it's always a good analogy. So say we wanted a ordinary car, like a Mercedes Benz. And you had a male, and the scientists created a male Mercedes Benz and a female Mercedes Benz. And when they got together, you parked them next to each other at night. They create little Mercedes Benzes. And if you give the little ones oil and enough gasoline, and you put a nice water into the cooler, then it grows up and it becomes a big Mercedes Benz. That way everyone can get a cheap Mercedes Benz. Have a little farm in your backyard for Mercedes Benz. But the scientists can't do that. But there is a scientist who has done it. His name is Krishna. He's created male and female machines in 8,400,000 species of life. And when they get together, they make little machines that make other machines. So he's the greatest scientist. Now, as he's the most intelligent, he also is unlimitedly happy and pleasureful. He has a world where people actually eat nicely. The atmosphere there's no contamination, there's no factories, so the air is completely spiritual and pure. The food is wonderful. The water is without any contamination. People are happy because they live forever there. They're not in material identification. So he's the worshipable deity called Krishna. And the process of realizing Krishna is the process of basically getting out of our material conception, just like if you want to become free, you have to get out of the jail. So although we love our body, it is actually a jail for us. Although we love our jail, and we wouldn't get out of it for anything. Just like they have birds in a cage, and sometimes they open the cage, and the bird gets out for a little while, but he's attached to the cage, so then he gets back into the cage. He thinks, oh, what would I do without the cage? I'd be hopeless, defenseless. I need the cage. And so the master leaves the cage open, the bird goes back. Similarly, we're thinking that without my material body, I couldn't possibly survive. Everything would go wrong. And therefore, we don't want to get out of the body because we don't know where else to go. We don't know what else to do. So bhakti yoga means, first of all, to understand that we're in the material world because basically the person who's actually created the world, the person who's maintaining the world, and under whose direction the world will be annihilated, the actual proprietor of the world, we're trying to steal from him his world. We're trying to falsely claim ourselves to be God here. Maybe a big God, maybe a little God. We're a little God, therefore we're not so bad. But actually, we've all come here to steal from God. And while we're stealing from God, some people think, well, I'm a nice thief. And some people think, oh, he's a bad thief. He's a dishonest thief. Just like a group of thieves, they got together, they robbed the bank. And they went to their hideout. And the head thief stood up and said, my dear fellow thieves, you did a great job. I must compliment you. 1, 2, 3. All glorious to the thieves. Thieves ki jai. But now that we've stolen all this money, I have only one request to all of you. Please, 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 let us divide this money up honestly. Similarly, we've come to the material world. We've denied the existence of God. We're trying to take his property and utilize it for our sense gratification, denying his request to us, and still we're trying to get together and claim ourselves to be honest, upright, moral persons. Although we've denied the existence of the actual proprietor, and we're trying to steal from him, we're claiming ourselves to be honest thieves. The first platform of devotion is to recognize that there is a proprietor of this world and we're not that. Ultimately, the world doesn't belong to us. It's been given to us by the Supreme Person, not for endless, aimless gratification of the senses, but ultimately to be utilized in service to the Supreme Lord. And basically, the Supreme Lord wants us to utilize it to try to engage in loving service to Him, to establish a relationship with Him based on love. A child, he may not have any money. His father may be a very wealthy person. But if the child offers to the father a couple of pennies, chewing gum, with devotion, then the father becomes very pleased. Not that the gift is very valuable to the father, but it's the devotion that the child offers it with. That's important to the father. Similarly, the Supreme Father simply wants us to develop our love and our devotion to Him. But first of all, we have to become aware of Him. So that's in Bhagavad Gita. Because without awareness of God, there's no question of love. If I claim I love this girl, I've fallen madly in love with her, I'm going to marry her next week. Oh, really? What's her name? Oh, I don't know. Really, what does she look like? I've never seen her. Really, what does she do? I have not the faintest idea. Do you know anything about it? No, I don't know anything. But I have fallen madly in love with her. I can't live without her. No, love means you have to get to know the person, what their names are, what the name is, what they look like, what they do, what their relationship is, how to establish the relationship. So that's called bhakti, to find out who Krishna is, who God is, how to establish a relationship with Him. That's called the process of bhakti yoga. So the Krishna says that's superior to the indirect way of trying to renounce our attachment to enjoying the results of our work, our anxiety over what's going to happen in the future, our lamentation over what happened in the past, realizing ourselves as spiritual beings by becoming undisturbed by the activities of this material world, and cultivating knowledge of how to meditate and how to focus the mind on one point, etc. From there, one still has to come to the platform of establishing relationship with the Supreme Person. To stop being a thief is one thing, but just by not being a thief doesn't mean that one's life is perfect. Just by not being in jail doesn't mean one's life is successful. One has to learn how to act in real society, in normal society, in such a way as to be progressive. So similarly, the yoga process is more or less the process by which we stop being thieves and we realize ourselves what an honest citizen is. And bhakti yoga means learn how an honest citizen works and acts and thinks and speaks and does things in such a way as to revive our relationship, a normal relationship with the Supreme. And the analogy is the government and the citizens in the government. And in our analogy, it's with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and Krishna's servants. But here Krishna says, that's superior, that to work in devotion, to learn the process of devotion, automatically we'll realize ourselves as spiritual beings. We'll not only realize our eternality, we'll understand how everyone and everything is related to the Supreme, and we'll become blissful, full of love for Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As we experience His unlimited love, our little bit of love becomes invoked, revived. Just like the little spark, when it's in the fire, it glows very brightly. Outside the fire, it becomes dull. If it falls into water, practically becomes extinguished. When it falls into wet grass, it may smolder for a while. But when it goes back into the fire, then it's glowing, its heat, everything revives again. So when we go back into the fire of spiritual life in Krishna consciousness, then our natural loving propensity increases unlimitedly in the brightness of the fire. Then we become happy, experiencing the unlimited heat and light of the fire and being able to appreciate how our own love, our own awareness increases also. When we become aware of the Supreme Aware Person, the Supreme Blissful Person, and His followers, His devotees. So here Krishna is recommending that this is the best process, called devotional service, bhakti yoga. The other ones are also nice because they help bring us to the platform where we can most intelligently, most determinedly, most devotedly perform the activities of devotional service to Krishna. So, thank you for listening. It's time to stop. Grandharaj Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Premanande.